You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. In these podcasts, we explore a huge range of crucial issues and exciting developments in the food industry with brilliant guests drawn from all areas of expertise. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a TV presenter and writer specializing in food and science. This podcast is all about becoming a sustainable business and achieving zero carbon status. So how hard is it to do? Why is it important? And where the hell do you start? Well, we're joined by some fantastic guests from very different backgrounds and very different sized businesses. We have Anna Pierce, Director of Sustainability at Tate & Lyle.
Hello.
Katie Leggett, Sustainability Cheerleader at Innocent Drinks.
Hello.
Alex Smith, Managing Director, Alaro Whole Foods.
Hello there.
And Andy Griffiths, Head of Value Chain Sustainability, Nestlé UK and Ireland.
Hi there.
Now let's start with Anna. Tate & Lyle is an ingredients business. Before you tell us about your sustainability journey, what actually matters to the business most in terms of sustainability? Is it a moral imperative? Is it government regulations that you have to adhere to? Or is it operational efficiency, or, you know, as other people might put it, cash, profit? Which are the most important parts for you?
I think for Tate & Lyle, it's really about a moral imperative. So as a purpose-driven company, we're committed to improving lives for generations. And part of doing that is caring for our planet. So it is one of the three pillars of our purpose, and we've really been working to infuse it into the way that Tate & Lyle does business, so it becomes part of our DNA and not an offshoot program.
Okay, so can you tell us a bit about the journey that you've made into becoming a sustainable business? When did it really kick off, and what stage do you feel you're at?
For Tate & Lyle, the journey began a few years ago. As we worked to become a more purpose-driven company, sustainability naturally came up as one of the ways that we can demonstrate that commitment to our purpose. From a journey perspective, I think if we look back at our 2020 sustainability environmental targets, there's certainly a CO2 reduction, there's a waste reduction, and there's not a water reduction. I think that speaks volumes to there was a real opportunity to just step up and do more. And the theme in our setting our 2030 targets has very much been around not what should we do, but what could we do. And if we look back a decade from now, will we feel as though we've done enough? So that's really helped shape our journey and setting our new targets that do now include a water reduction target and ambitious greenhouse gas reductions, as well as a commitment to sustainable agriculture. So that kind of gut check is what really helped us set the stage for the kind of company and the kind of program we want to have and we want to be.
So what have been, if you can give us some specifics, what have been the biggest changes and challenges? What actual things that that have been actioned?
Sure. So we started out in 2018 with a pilot on a little more than 300,000 acres in the Midwest U.S., to support sustainable agriculture in a partnership with Truterra, that's formerly Land O'Lakes Sustain. And we expanded from that pilot to commit to supporting 1.5 million acres of sustainable agriculture. So for us, that's equivalent to our global annual corn procurement volume. And that program arose very quickly. Because we really looked at what was our opportunity for impact. And given the amount of corn that we source, if we're going to have an impact on the environment, that was one of the best ways that we could do it. And we could also partner with our customers to enable them to achieve their sustainability goals. So it's very much a program that became bigger than an internal target. And we're really developing to focus on what can we do together with customers and stakeholders to have an environmental impact and really support farmers in their conservation practices and on their own journeys.
And what were the actual changes that you managed to put into effect?
So we've seen in the first year-over-year results on our pilot, we've seen a 10% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. We've seen advances in the adoption of conservation practices by the farmers that helped to achieve those greenhouse gas reductions. We've seen nice improvements in soil quality and soil health, which starts to lean into some of our customers' ambitions to achieve net zero, and really be able to partner with them to help them achieve some of those net zero targets. It also helps us and our customers achieve our Scope 3 emission reduction targets. Now, along with that, when we get outside of soil health, we've also seen a nice reduction in topsoil erosion, so 6% reduction there, which leads to more soil on farm, obviously, but then it also leads to better watershed improvements. Mm. So we've started to see nice results early on that the acceleration of adopting conservation practices and really working with the farmers and the agricultural retailers within the Truterra network that help provide them with technical expertise as well as seeds and fertilizers and soil sampling, it enables the farmers to make more informed decisions about their agricultural practices so they can do the right thing for the environment, but also for the profitability of their farm.
Okay, fantastic. Now let's move on to Andy. Now, Nestle is obviously the largest food company in the world. How did it start on its journey to sustainability? And as such a big business, how have you prioritized your focus? I mean, the scale of the business is so vast. I presume it's difficult to change such a vast company, but if you can achieve change, it has a massive impact.
Well, if you look at kind of one of our key thematic approaches is to think global and act local, and that really plays through well. So we can start to look at how our footprint is structured and as a result where the key priorities sit, both in terms of key ingredients, key commodities, but also in terms of sourcing locations as well. And then alongside that, actually activate the local insight and the local network, the local relationships that we have to really deliver change. And that's worked really well, both within the business in terms of the way we structure our champions network and share insights and best practice. And then externally in terms of the individual programs that we run. So for example, in the UK, we've done a lot of work looking at where our core footprint sits. Clearly dairy is one of those challenges. And what we've been doing over the last 3 years is working with our dairy farmers and our dairy supplier to understand where those challenges are, what actions will deliver best benefit, and then helping to bring in funding. So initially from us, but looking at shared interest investments, so bringing other organisations into that proposition as well to co-invest into those farmers and enable them to implement practices and interventions to not only reduce their carbon footprint, but also to deliver a range of other outcomes. So, for example, reduce flood risk, improved water quality, improved air quality, all of which are key issues and very relevant to organisations who sit within that locality.
And can you give us any specific examples of the changes that have been made that have had an impact?
Yeah, so the dairy farmers in the UK have been implementing a range of different interventions. If you looked maybe 3 years ago, we had about 11% of our dairy farmers on some form of stewardship scheme. And through this program, we basically brought in key experts from the agricultural sector, but also from some of the other ENGOs to help support and advise them. And a range of interventions. So we were really clear that we didn't specify the interventions. We specified the outcomes. So this is what we want. And then those advisory partners can come in and help advise the farmers in terms of which kind of interventions were most appropriate for their farm type, but would also deliver the right kind of outcomes. So, for example, we have a number of different interventions, some of which were practice related. So looking at how they manage the fields, manage the movement of their stock, how they manage their silage camps and slurry stores. Some of them required capital investment to deliver that as well. But then also there were some broader nature-based solutions. So, for example, looking at riverine planting or fencing to reduce cattle stepping into the waterways and increasing flood risk or sedimentation there. And really interesting, once you start to build that engagement, give them the ability to select the right interventions which work for them whilst also delivering the outcomes we want, you gain a significant level of trust. And because they're receiving payment for the delivery of those outcomes, they see it very much as a business-to-business proposition. And as a result, for the last 2 years, we've seen every single one of our dairy farmers delivering nature-based solutions as part of that program.
That sounds really exciting. Now, in terms of the burden on Nestlé, is it a cost burden? Is it a knowledge transfer burden? Or is it just the impact of change that Nestlé has to deal with in order to make these things happen?
The key element for us is thinking about these challenges in a really integrated way, looking at the food system as a whole and understanding how we best influence that. So for us, clearly there are a number of challenges that we're facing into. The agri-food sector is clearly facing core challenges from a climate change perspective and in terms of the state of nature. And what we believe is that by taking a much more integrated approach, we can help address concerns and challenges around environmental outcomes, so helping to mitigate those impacts of climate change, helping to regenerate and enhance nature within those landscapes, but also delivering supply resiliency back into the business and delivering increased efficiencies across that food system as well. So always concerned about focusing on one particular element because there's a risk that you either don't fully optimize the solution or you create unintended consequences. Mm. If we think about the system as a whole, there are a range of different business drivers and opportunities that can be leveraged.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to Alex. Now, there's a very different story behind Alaro Whole Foods. I mean, as far as I understand it, it's, you know, social consciousness has been fundamental to the company right from the start. Can you tell us about your story, because caring for the environment has always been core to what you do. And I assume you haven't had to change fundamentally. It was right there from the get-go. As you've grown, how have you kept this going?
Well, I suppose we are fundamentally at opposite ends of the scale to Nestlé, in that I started the business in 1976. Having just spent a year living with no money at all. Mm. And I started the business with £2 on the street. I found it in the gutter. And I started Alara with £2 I found on the street. And as you say, we've been engaged in this journey ever since then. So for instance, in 1976, we were the very first muesli manufacturer anywhere in the world to make muesli without added sugar. In 1986, we were the first cereal company in the world to be certified organic. In 1988, we were the first cereal manufacturer to be certified fair trade. In 2009, we were the first food manufacturer anywhere in the world to be zero waste. In 2016, we made the very big boast that we were the most sustainable food manufacturer on earth. I'll come back to the measures on that. Mm. We've since then become the very first food brand to be plastic free. And we've now got a new mission, which is to make organic food you can afford. So our previous mission was to be the most sustainable food manufacturer on earth. Mm. That's now changed to organic food you can afford. I'll go back then to the four measures we used for our rather big boast, the most sustainable food manufacturer on earth. And in a way, what that was based on is the 17 UN Sustainable Development Goals. Mm. And what we did was we broke those down into four key measures. So we have an environmental measure, and our environmental measure is carbon in. What that means is that we've developed over the last 15 years our own in-house database system that calculates all of the embedded CO2e in all of the food we produce. We put this publicly up on our website, so you can go to our website and you can see the calculations. And then we work with a charity, Rainforest Saver, who's working in Guyana, in Ecuador, and Sierra Leone. They're working with indigenous farmers who've been practicing slash and burn farming, introducing an agricultural system called Inga Ali cropping. We know that for each pound we contribute, an Inga tree gets planted. Over 20 years, that Inga tree sequesters a ton of CO2. So we then balance the embedded CO2 in all of the food we produce with the contribution we make to Rainforest Saver.
Yeah.
So that's our environmental measure. Our financial measure, because finance, you know, if we go bust, it's not very sustainable. But what we have as our financial measure is COD. So we have absolutely no creditors. We pay, we don't have a creditor book in the company. Mm. When we get goods into the business, we pay immediately. We check, obviously, the qualities, right? I'll say here that we're BRC AA grade with gluten-free additions and ISO 14001 and all the rest of these sort of quality standards. But whenever we get product into our factory, we pay for it immediately. Lots of companies say, oh, we really work with our suppliers. We want to work with our suppliers and all the rest of it. We think the best way we can actually support our suppliers is not taking credit from them. Hmm. We pay them immediately. So that's our financial measure. Our social measure is we're very, very embedded in our community here. Our factory is in King's Cross in central London. I'm chair of the Camley Street Neighbourhood Forum. We've produced a big neighbourhood plan. We're just working on development plans now for 1,000 affordable homes, new factories, new industrial space here in King's Cross. But our social measure is great parties. So we bring all of the people from the surrounding area here, all of our stakeholders. We won't have a harvest festival. We've got 250 fruit trees around our factory here. We grow 80 different food crops around our factory. I've just come in from the garden now. I was picking and eating figs, grapes. I picked some little pumpkins, some chilies. This is from our garden in King's Cross. And we have a harvest festival in September and a wassailing party. Last harvest festival, we had over 1,000 people here. Everything's free, food's free, drinks free, dancing's free, games, all the children come in for free. So that's our social measure. And the last one people forget about is our governance measure. Now, as you can imagine, anybody, I think everybody here's in a food manufacturing business. We get audited by, you know, all the multiple retailers we make own label for, BRC, ISO 14001, Fair Trade, Uncle Joe Cobbler, and all comes in sometimes. Now, just about everybody keeps all of those audits secret. We don't. This is including pest control too, I might add. Mm. All of those audits we make public. It's amazing that what our customers do is they allow us to do something extraordinarily intimate. They trust us that the food we make in our factory here goes to them, and they actually put it in their mouths. Can you think of anything more intimate than that? So we think it's absolutely a key governance point on our part to give them as much third-party insight into the conditions under which their products are being made. So that's our governance measure. Mm. And it's on the basis of those measures that we think, and, you know, I'm chair of the Food and Drink Organic Committee and various other bodies. So I've given talks fairly often about what these measures are. And so far, I haven't had anybody come to me and say, oh, look, Alex, we don't think they're adequate measures. We think these ones are better. And I'm, you know, hoping and waiting for somebody to come to me and say, oh, we think one of your measures could be improved this way, or we don't agree with that one. I'm very keen to learn. But so far, over the last 5 years, nobody has.
Now, we've got lots of different companies of different sizes here. Do you think that the principles on which your business is based should really be every company's basis?
Yes, I do. I can't see any reason why it shouldn't be. I always remember listening to a company, how to start a company, and they had four business development experts there, and they all had four, a range of different things that they thought somebody starting a business ought to do. There was only one thing that those four experts had in common, and that one thing they had in common was borrow as much money as you possibly can. That was the only thing they had in common. Now, to be honest, I think it is wrong. I won't say wrong, but if you want to be a sustainable business, my own view is that you need to be supporting your supply chain absolutely as much as you possibly can, because that's sustainable. It's encouraging diversity in supply chain. So to take credit, there's the famous saying, how does it go? Turnover is vanity, profit is sanity, cash flow is reality. So to deprive suppliers of the reality of their continued business by taking credit from them, to my mind, isn't a sustainable way of going about things. Mm. I appreciate that it's an extremely good business. It's how most businesses get built. But from a sustainability point of view, I don't believe it is.
That's stage one. Okay, well, we've got lots of questions where everyone's different viewpoints are going to be really interesting. I'd just like to move on to Katie and learn a little bit about Innocent. Now, Innocent's a very different business now than when the company was a cheeky startup led by three mates. It's now owned by Coca-Cola. It's gone through a big fundamental change. But what's been the company's journey, sustainability journey, and how's this changed as the company has evolved and been owned by different owners?
Of course, like any company, Innocent's been on a journey, but that's such a typical sustainability thing to say that I'm actually maybe not sure I should say that. But anyway, so we have. Though, obviously, like any business, had some things that have changed over time. I would say we started out, as you rightly pointed out, a kind of cheeky startup without really any sustainability expertise, but with a, I hope the founders wouldn't mind me saying that, but with real ambition and like genuine values of wanting to do the right thing for both the people that worked for the business, people that were working in our supply chains, and for the planet. So a lot of the things that we did in those early days were really pioneering. And so, for example, I would say we're pioneering in the use of recycled plastic in our bottles, for example, back in 2003. That's now something that feels really big, especially in the drink space. And we've obviously seen a real evolution in how much people are talking about plastics. And then I'd say over the last 10 years or so, bearing in mind also Innocent is only 21 years old this year, so we're not an old company, but in the last 10 years we've really spent a lot of time becoming much more specific and much more much more advanced in how we talk technically about sustainability. Obviously, like most of the businesses here today, we have a team of sustainability experts on specific areas, so climate change, sustainable agriculture, all of the work we do on plastics, technical plastics, and that, I think, with that expertise, we have become, as I said, much more specific and much more targets driven. But that, of course, has that's all come from a place of being values driven from the very start. And I think similar to what Alex was saying, I suppose when the founders of your business genuinely have a belief and a set of values, you really feel that even a situation where the business grows and, as you rightly pointed out, your ownership changes. And that, I think, is what has led Innocent to become, we actually became B Corp certified a couple of years ago. And that B Corp certification is essentially it standing up and saying, we think we were doing the right things before, but we want to make sure that we've got kind of external validation that that's the right thing to do through the B Corp impact assessment. And that, again, similarly to what Alex was just saying, is based not just on our sustainability criteria, but the way in which our business is governed and the fact that we are committed not just to produce profit to our shareholders, but to produce value to our stakeholders. So that's anyone that has a stake in our business or our value chains. And also things like creating good quality products that do good for both people and planet. So I would say we've been on an evolution, and I'd say that evolution has come from being really values led, and then over the years, as with any organization, we've just become more specific and probably more we have gathered more expertise and then became B Corp to just, you know, rubber stamp the fact that we were doing business in the right way.
And how has this evolved for Innocent? So, I mean, obviously 21 years is a small amount of time, but it's also a long amount of time when we're thinking about changes in things like legislation. And I'm interested in both you and Alex's sense of the impact that changing legislation has on the smaller side of businesses. How has that affected how you work?
When I started, as I said, I started with £2 I found on the street. And what I did was I was living in a squat. So I squatted a shop. Squatting shops isn't allowed anymore. And the first thing I started selling was thrown away fruit and vegetables from Nine Elms Market, from the bins at Nine Elms Market. Now, selling thrown away fruit and vegetables isn't allowed anymore either. So, you know, the two basic foundations of the business, squatting a shop and selling thrown away fruit and vegetables, they're out now. So that's a very simple way of how legislation has changed to prevent me starting a business again in the same way that I did then.
But how about environmental legislation? Have you had to change the way that you do business because of changes in regulations and legislation?
Yeah, you know, I mean, all of the waste regulations that we now have to report on, you know, all of the waste that we're putting into the environment. I mean, the thing is that the actual factory itself here is zero waste, so we don't actually have any waste streams. All of the plastic and the paper that we generate in the factory here is now a profit centre. You know, or any edible food, it goes to a charity called Food for All. We actually have a food hub here for them, so we store food on site here, both from ourselves and from other people, and they distribute it to here to people. You know, food parcels go out from here, basically.
But have the changes in legislation, do they have a disproportionate effect, do you think, on the small business like yours? Or are they easy to incorporate?
No, you know, I mean, generating the data to report on all of the packaging that we send out to the environment, you know, that's a huge job. But, you know, I mean, that was the biggest job. But I suppose, in a way, what we've done is we've spent over £500,000 developing our own database system here. And we've honed that now to generate more or less any report that we want. So, you know, waste paper, all of our BRC reports, all of our Soil Association organic reports, ISO 14001. So all of these sorts of legislative requirements, we can get reports from our database. So to that extent that we've spent a lot of time, a lot of effort, you know, we've been developing it for 25 years and we're still developing it now, then having that as the backbone of our reporting system and our control system in the business allows us to incorporate changes in legislation fairly easily. But I'd imagine if you don't have that backbone, then it could be a real problem.
Yeah. And Anna, for the larger business perspective, has changing legislation affected you disproportionately because of the size of your business?
I don't think so. I mean, from our perspective, as legislation changes or as people's mindset changes, right? So we're all becoming a bit more environmentally conscious than perhaps we were 5 years ago. I think that for us, there's and certainly larger companies, there's more resources to develop programs that not only meet regulatory requirements but exceed them. But I also think that we also have a larger footprint to manage as well. So those two generally go hand in hand. So I don't see there being a disadvantage to smaller companies versus larger companies. It's in all purposes the same set of challenges. Yeah. It's just the scale.
Yeah. Okay. And Andy, now if we're looking at companies that maybe have only just started to embrace sustainability, how do you, what are the stress points in a company that you need to be concerned about? What are the big changes in kind of company culture that need to happen?
Yeah, it's a really good question. We've been working on our journey for many years now. And have been able to kind of test and explore some of the challenges that you face into. I think one of the core ones is complexity. So, you know, for a large organisation particularly, but for any organisation who's operating in the agri-food sector, it can be quite a complex, kind of infrastructure on which you're dependent. So really trying to understand that and map that out is important. However, you know, not waiting to do that before you take action is also important. You know, we need to have information which is good enough to enable us to take action and move forward. So that's one really crucial element. Another one is very much about how you engage your own employees in terms of understanding the importance and relevance of the journey. But really importantly, identifying how we can make this subject relevant to them. So not everyone has the same drivers or the same belief systems. So really trying to understand and structure your approach so it can play to those different interests within the organisation is really important. And we've seen significant shifts as a result. So for example, in the UK, we've one of the core areas we've focused on is waste and food waste. And everybody innately, or most people, have a feeling that food waste is bad. But actually getting people to modify the behaviours to manage that on an ongoing basis in sometimes the heat of the moment, you know, when you're on a production line or, you know, when you stood on the, in the dockyard, it can be challenging. So what we did was really start to look at how we make that messaging and the importance of that relevant to our people. And in the UK, you know, at the moment, even pre-COVID, kind of one in five under 15-year-olds was living in a household where they're struggling to put food on the table. That means for most of their employees, they will have friends or neighbours who may well be in the same boat. And suddenly there was that real understanding, that reality, in terms of why this was important and therefore why I should engage as an individual. And what we've seen as we've progressed that journey, you know, we had a target to achieve zero waste for disposal status across our entire operation by 2020. We actually achieved that back in 2015. And then also subsequent to that, have reduced the amount of our other waste. Not our waste streams, but our potential waste streams that will go into waste to energy by another 70% since 2010. And then on top of that, we've been able to reduce our food waste by another 24%. since 2016. So we thought we were in quite a good place, and actually the opportunities to reduce food waste were going to be relatively small. But by having that level of engagement, that level of energy and enthusiasm, and really having people who were picking up every stone and looking underneath to try and find those opportunities, has really helped us to accelerate that journey and drive out further opportunities within the business.
And Katie, I mean, the fact that Innocent has a sustainability cheerleader sort of seems to chime pretty clearly with what Andy says, that it starts from within. Is that your experience?
100%. And I couldn't agree more with what Andy's saying about the importance of engaging your employees and your colleagues, because the thing is, if you strip all the people out of an organization, you don't really have a business. So if you want to be a truly responsible business, you have to have people engaged in your organization that really genuinely care about being a responsible business and are both willing but also take the initiative to build that responsible business for you, based on obviously some principles to share and educate them about. But what we found really useful is that every single person at Innocent has a responsible business role, part of their objectives. And how we make that work is that actually almost opposite to what Andy was just saying, is we say we've got four different banner roles that you could have, and then we'd like you to set your own objective, because you know the people in our organization could choose that they're really passionate building more nutritious products because they have a background in food science and they want to get involved that way. Mm-hmm. But they also might say, I want to be in charge of making sure that my team reduce their paper use because I really care about sustainability. So by using those four banner kind of roles, by using those and then almost passing over to our employees and saying, I say our employees, my colleagues, and you know, what do you guys think? Don't look, guys, know what your role is. How do you think you can invest time and be involved in being a responsible business? We found that to be a really successful way of engaging our employees in delivering the responsible business ambitions that we have.
Okay, so now we're actually beginning to run out of time. I think we've only just really scratched the surface of this. So two quick fire rounds of answers, very short answers if you don't mind. Let's start with Alex. For a company that is on the road to becoming sustainable, I know that you have it at the core of your business, but what's the one key message or one bit of advice that you would give to a business if they're at the start of this journey? What should they take into account? What should they be doing or thinking? What's the biggest issue for you?
I'd say the biggest issue for me is that I'll put it slightly, using a slightly long word here. What we are right now is society is in a bifurcation point. And we either move through this bifurcation point to a sustainable future, which is a truly amazing place, or society will collapse. So if you want to be part of this transition to a sustainable future, then get on board. If you don't, then you're going to be aiding the collapse of society, and that's going to be truly terrible.
I love it. Yeah, good and dramatic and hard hitting. Why the heck not? Okay. And how about Anna? So, what's the one key message you think is helpful to a business at the start of their journey to becoming sustainable?
I really think it's challenge yourselves. Part of the targets that we have set and the ambitious targets that we've set is because we continually were asking, is this enough? Can we do more? Is this really enough? And really revisiting that process and having different members of our leadership team and our board asking that question over and over as we went through, you know, setting the targets in that process, I think is incredibly valuable. So I think sometimes we set targets and we're like, whew, okay, we got that done. Now we'll go work on them next year, versus really sitting back and working through the process of that internal question of, are we doing enough?
And Andy from Nestle, what would your key message be to businesses at the start of their sustainability journey?
I'd echo Anna's comments. I think challenge yourselves. The more you look, the more you find. Mm-hmm. I think engaging with others and really sharing insights and looking for genuine action-orientated collaboration. You hear a lot about collaboration, but really looking at how you can work together to drive impact is really important. And when you're thinking about a business case, thinking about it in its entirety, there are a phenomenal amount of projects or programs which could deliver significant benefits that are seen not to be business relevant. Actually, when you think about the broader context of business relevance, many of those projects can be star projects.
Yeah, yeah. Fantastic. Okay. Katie, what would your advice be to businesses on their journey to sustainability?
I would say that if I was advising a business, big or small or new or old, actually, that joining the B Corp movement and looking into what the B Corp movement has to offer is such a genuine pathway for improvement. It allows you to both know where you stand on your social environmental footprint now, but also shows you how you can improve. But more than just being a certification, it's about being part of a movement. So about collaboration across industries and across across your competitors even. And for me, and I think at Innocent, we've just found a real genuine connection in terms of values with the B Corp movement. And so I would urge a company looking into how they can improve their sustainability agenda to look into the B Corp movement, because I think it just provides a really amazing starting point for any business of any size, really.
Yeah, fantastic. I like that. A good practical bit of advice as well. I think that's fantastic. Well, you've been listening to the Table Talk podcast brought to you by Food Matters, and you heard from Anna Pierce from Tate & Lyle, Katie Leggett from Innocent Drinks, Alex Smith from Alara Whole Foods, Andy Griffiths from Nestle, and me, Stephen Gates. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us today. Now, if you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from personalized nutrition to data-driven agriculture. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Goodbye. You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, please visit foodmatters.co.uk.